Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. One of the things that most strongly characterizes the style of practice and teaching of Lumpur Cha and this collection of monasteries that he founded and have been established according to his understanding, his way of practice, of his way of teaching, is the cultivation of the quality of community and the use of community as a conscious form of training. This is a quality that is somewhat unique, and particularly because in many of the forest monasteries of Thailand, the ethic, the standard way of practice is very much a minimum of group activity, a minimum of say group chanting and communal meditation. The encouragement is always go back to your kuti, practice by yourself, minimum of ceremonies and group activity, and go to your kuti, do walking, sitting, meditation. And that's the standard and form that is the pattern, the structure of life in many forest monasteries, particularly those that have been founded out of the lineage of Lungpu Man. So Ajahn Chah's own style was much more to employ a communality, practicing meditation together with others, engaging in group activities, puja together, work projects around the monastery together, and the active use of community as a form of training. So many of us are very familiar with this principle, and this has been the fabric or the form, the basic framework for our life for many, many years. But it's always good to reflect upon what basis Lumpur Cha established this. Even though he was actually criticized, you know, the other forest ajahns would say, find fault with that way of practice, saying that you couldn't develop such good samadhi, you had to spend so much time working with other people, and you couldn't establish the kind of solitude and focus that was needed for deep states of jhana. Lumpur Cha saw that there were other qualities that were developed through this aspect of communality, of living and working closely together with others, that he found for himself more valuable. And one of the reasons is because, as he found for himself as a young monk, when he went traveling and living on Tudong, wandering through the countryside and staying in different places for a number of years, he saw that if he was by himself, living off in the forests or off in the hills, it was quite easy for him to be able to establish deep states of meditation and to find qualities of a great peacefulness and clarity, understanding, and deep states of samadhi. But when he was with other people, when he had to go and spend the rains retreat with others, or he needed to go and live in monasteries where other people were dwelling, when he had to live in close connection with other monks and novices, then that's when he would find that he was most tested. He would lose his temper, he would get critical, he would get impatient, restless, and stirred up in various ways. And as we know, many of us are now familiar with how astute Lumpur Cha was, and he saw that that he didn't need to just play to his strong suit, as it were, but just choose the way that was most, say, simple or automatically conducive. He saw that that where he really needed to learn some lessons was with being with other people. He saw that that being by himself in a way was a very easy form of practice, but it dodged around a lot of his root defilements. It skirted around them, evaded them, and so he realized that if he truly wanted to free and to liberate his heart, if he truly wanted to wake up, he needed to look at those areas where he was stuck. He needed to look at those latent tendencies, those deeply rooted defilements. And so he instead directed his attention towards living with others, because he saw that it was more challenging and brought up more stuff, more friction within him. But he realized that he learned some very, very important lessons. He developed some qualities that he was never going to develop if he just took the path of least resistance, as it were, and spent time just by himself and didn't challenge those habits, those deeply rooted attachments and biases within himself. And he found that it was such a rich source of wisdom and benefit for himself that it became the whole style of practice, so that within Wat Bo Phong and the branches that have been established since then, 300 or so different branches around Thailand and other countries around the world, this is in a way the hallmark of this style of practice. And it's good to reflect on this. Why would you want to be, in a way, setting things up so it was in a way less conducive to deep states of concentration and in a way inviting more difficulty? Why would you do that? What's the point? Why would you, in a sense, make more challenges for yourself? Also reminded of a conversation that Lompo Samato recounted when he came back from Thailand the very first time he went to visit after Chithurst Monastery had been started in 1981. In the early months of 81, he went back to visit Thailand, and Lompo asked him how it was going, and he said, "Oh, it's so great. Things are going, Chithurst, well, the house still needs a lot of work on it, but the community there is really great. I've never lived with such a group of diligent, committed, sincere people. The monks are all very strict with their Vinaya practice and very helpful and committed. And the group of nuns, in newly ordained group of eight precept nuns, are similarly very, very committed, very sincere, and very diligent in their practice. And and everyone is really works very hard to be helpful and kind and generous, energetic." He said, "I never lived with such a harmonious and helpful, inspiring group of people." And he was waxing lyrically on those lines and just extolling the virtues of the wonderful community in the early days of Chithurst. And as he paused for breath, then Lumpo grunted, "Well, you won't develop very much wisdom living with that lot." Thoroughly unimpressed with all this wonderful harmony and goodness and happiness, and how sweet and fine it was with this particular group of people. And he didn't say, "I'll send you a few, I'll send you a few difficult characters," but I think he knew that would come in the natural course of time. But that was a comment, and it struck Lompo Samato very deeply. "You won't develop very much wisdom living with that lot." And seeing how we can rejoice with living in an easy and pleasant, very conducive situation, but often what we really learn from is the points of friction where we are living next door to someone that we don't get on with, or that we are having to work together with others. We like to go fast; they like to go slow. We like salty; they like sweet. We like strong, they like mild, and having to learn how to accommodate and to get along with others when there are those points of friction. And that, even though the quality of harmony, samagi, and let's say peacefulness is highly praised within in Buddha Dhamma, then what Lumpur Cha's attitude and what his teaching is pointing towards here is not finding harmony through the avoidance of difficulty, not through just finding happiness through avoiding or shutting out all the things that we don't like, but more digging deeper into the heart to find a space, to find a quality of inclusion, a quality of accommodation for all things that that we didn't realize that we had the capacity for, like digging deeper into our heart to find more space within us, to find a greater degree of wisdom, a greater degree of acceptance, then we are habitually seeing within ourselves, than we are habitually using. So, in a sense, challenging our own habits, challenging our biases, challenging our familiar ways of doing things to get bigger, to be stretching our capacity to develop a greater sense of accommodation. So in a way that we are certainly seeking harmony, seeking samagi, concord, but we're not seeking it through superficial means, just sugaring things over or avoiding difficulty, but getting to that place of a deeper concord, a more radical and complete concord. And that's the aim of this kind of choosing to learn from friction, choosing to learn from being with others that we might not choose to be so close with, learning to get along with others in a direct and practical way. You know, our tendency is to judge the world according to our own preferences, our own conditioning, and what we like we call good, and what we don't like we call not good. But also a phrase comes to mind that when a couple of years ago, when Lumpur and myself, Ajahn Yanarato, were invited to go to Japan, at a certain point we were visiting Koya-san, Mount Koya, which is the epicenter of Shingon Buddhism in Japan. And but even though Shingon is less well known in the West, in Japan it's actually has a much larger presence than Zen Buddhism. So the two main forms of practice that you meet, at least I found that we met as we were traveling around in Japan, was Pure Land Buddhism and Shingon. And Shingon is more of the kind of esoteric school and has a lot of the sort of magical and symbolic practices involved within it. Very glorious that when you go to a Shingon temple, if you go into the main shrine room, three quarters of the shrine room is the shrine, and there's about a quarter of it is actually the space where the humans can occupy. You have lots of images and symbolic features on the shrine. So we were in Koya-san, which is the epicenter of Shingon Buddhism. It was the main teaching center established by Kobo Daishi, the founder of Shingon Buddhism. And one day we were being given a tour around some of the main Shingon temples, and this particular place we were taken to, they had this very large stone garden, a rock garden. So as people are familiar with seeing in Zen temples, or you'd see photographs of Zen monasteries, a garden of raked gravel and a few carefully placed stones, large rocks within the surround of carefully nurtured and raked gravel. And in this Shingon temple, they had a similar stone garden, rock garden, but it was huge. It was probably about half an acre, or maybe three quarters of an acre. And so we were standing in this veranda, looking out over this big rock garden. And our guide, who was a Shingon devotee, said, "Zen people say this is too big and too many rocks." this garden is too big and has too many rocks. Shingon people say there are many colors in the universe. So I thought that was a really, and there was this kind of neat little smile on her face as she said this. But I thought it was a very astute and beautiful way of phrasing things. According to the Zen tradition, you had to have it a particular size. These things were always small and compact, contained, and just had a few perfectly arranged rocks. And then here was this Shingon arrangement, which was huge, and many, many rocks scattered around amongst the gravel in a very well-ordered and thoughtful and inspired forms, but definitely a lot more rocks. And but that comment of saying, the Zen people say, there are too many rocks. Shingon people say, there are many colors in the universe. And that quality of saying, there are many colors in the universe. There are all sorts of different ways that we exist in the world. There are those of us who are extrovert, those who are introvert, those who have a lot to say, those who have a little to say, those who like to be with others, those who like to be alone, those who like sweet, those who like sour, those who like fast, those who like slow, and so on. And it was a simple phrase, but that simple statement, there are many colors in the universe, I felt that was a very beautiful way of expressing that spirit of accommodation, of making space for the others. And so I find that's a phrase that's stuck in my mind, particularly in terms of living in community and coming into contact with others, working with others, living together with others, and seeing the different personalities that we all have. The different people that we meet, the different people that we live with, just to recollect that, that there isn't just my color, there isn't just my style, my form, my way of doing things, but there are many colors in the universe, and that just because I'm familiar with this particular kind, or I this is my favorite color, or I think this is beautiful, and the others are not so beautiful, that just to reflect in that way and to recognize, my way is not the only way. My perception is not the only perception. My preferences are simply a conditioned set of patterns that happen to be pleasing at this particular corner. But there are many colors in the universe. And so what makes my color right and good and somebody else's color different and wrong? It's ridiculous. Foolish, narrow and shallow. Now, when we consider the quality of being accommodating or making space for others, then sometimes we can hear that and we can, in a way, take that principle and we can, in a way, mishandle it or misunderstand it and take a sort of adaptability to an extreme. So when we talk about being adaptable or accommodating to others, adaptability doesn't mean being boneless. It doesn't mean being sort of totally floppy and in a sense, just going along with the feeling or the need or the spirit of a particular moment without any kind of wisdom. To be adaptable doesn't mean just to be a doormat and just say, oh yes, okay, whatever, and just to be passive, to be floppy, to be boneless, it's not a matter of, say, being weak or just having no particular say, or feeling that this kind of encouragement is asking us to be completely inert or passive and just say yes to whatever is asked of us or whatever is going on, because it's more that this kind of adaptability, it's more like what you find in a tree, like a tree, it needs both strength to stand up, for the branches to reach up and to support the twigs and the leaves, and you hold the leaves up out in the sunlight so they can soak up the sun and do their job as leaves. So a tree needs strength, it needs firmness, but also it needs flexibility. It needs that capacity to bend in the wind, so that just the same way in our practice, in our way of being, we do need flexibility. We do need that quality of accommodation, of adapting to circumstance. But that adaptability is also needs to be blended in a natural and complete, a full way with the quality of strength. And so, in a way, what our strength is, or that forms the backbone, or the main structure of our lives as Buddhist practitioners, is the refuge in the Triple Gem, taking refuge and commitment to Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. So every time we do the chanting, it's over and over again, Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha. That refuge, the Triple Gem, that is the chief resource. That's the bones, that's the trunk and the branches of our spiritual life. That's the firm and steady structure upon which our commitment is built. So that forms the strength side. But if a tree is rigid, if it's only got strength and no flexibility, then if the wind blows strongly, then it becomes, the tree is bound to break. It's going to be brittle. It's going to snap in the wind. If the wind is strong enough, then if the tree can't bend, then the twigs and the branches are going to break. They have to. So similarly, that we need flexibility. We need the quality of adaptation, adaptability, being able to accommodate circumstances. And so, just like a tree, there's a strength there, but there's a flexibility, and they work perfectly together. So for our practice, then that quality of flexibility is really to do with satya sampajanya, mindfulness, clear comprehension, that sense of the time, the place, the situation, what is needed, what's appropriate, what fits in with this particular unique circumstance of this this conversation, this moment, this exchange, this task at hand, whether we're eating a meal, we're talking to someone, we're writing a letter, we're digging a hole in the ground, or scraping the old paint off the ceiling of the boiler house, whatever it is that we happen to be doing, that quality of attention, bringing mindfulness to what we're doing, and the quality of clear comprehension, or intuitive awareness, is Lumpo Sumedho's translation. Sati Sampajanya, that is, in a sense, as I've been reflecting on this, that's really the quality of flexibility, that sense of adaptability. It's that acute and alert interest that the mind can bring to each moment to say, well, what's needed here? What's going on? What's happening? What's the pattern of experience in this moment? And how can this heart, this being, fit in with the circumstance? And how can this being be in accord, be in concord, be in harmony with the time, the place, the situation, the needs of this moment? What way can the actions and the attitudes of this being be brought into a state of concord, of harmony, be attuned to the way things are right now, and to be of the greatest benefit, and to minimize the amount of stress or dukkha that's coming from our engagement with the present moment. So then it's good to also, in terms of understanding or looking at the quality of samagi, of concord, of learning how to live with others, to consider what is it that makes us out of harmony? What are the things that, say, cause discord? When we are wise, or that friction that we, when we meet with others and we And we have that sense of, oh, I don't like that, or that's not right, or, you know, he's going too fast, or she's going too slow, or, you know, that's not being done right, or I want more of this, and, you know, I don't like that. You know, that, as Lumpur Cha's style of practice is pointing to, it's meeting with those points of friction and recognizing, ah, oh, here's something to learn from. Here's a... an opportunity to adapt, to get bigger, to accommodate, to learn how to fit together with something different. So that when we are attentive, when there is mindfulness and clear comprehension, then that friction, that difficulty, that being meeting with that which we wouldn't choose or that is it goes against our preferences, that is a cause for wisdom. We have to get smart. We have to, you know, get wise. We really have to draw on our resources. We have to raise our game to meet that, so that it does help us to develop a greater capacity, a greater and deeper understanding of ourselves and of the world around us, and a greater capacity to understand and relate compassionately and wisely with others. But if we're not wise, if we don't meet that friction with wisdom, then it just creates greater discord and greater say stress and difficulty, a sense of burden and restriction, confinement, dukkha within ourselves. Now, essentially, what obstructs that capacity to learn or to use friction and difficulty to develop wisdom is tanha, is craving, isn't it? That's the different kinds of tanha that we are habituated to. That's what, say, is always feeding the forces of dukkha. You know, it's the very cause of dukkha itself, as we all know. Second Noble Truth, you know, the cause of dukkha, the arising of dukkha is brought about through craving, tanha. That's the troublemaker, that's the cause. So that if we're looking for what obstructs harmony, if we're looking for, you know, why it is that we can't get along with this person, or why we're struggling against this particular aspect of our life or our training or the way things are, then we don't have to look too far. We'll see that it's craving, it's tanha, is the cause, the various different kinds of wanting that go on within us. That's what causes the blindness. That's what, say, stops us from being able to employ wisdom, and that deludes our senses, that deludes the mind to say, no, that is wrong, he shouldn't do that, and I do want more of this, and she shouldn't be that way, and that is right, and you know, that is wrong, and no, this isn't just a perception, it's a fact, you know, it is that way. And that's tanha, that's clouding the vision, that's making the mind believe in its judgments, believe in its habitual perceptions, taking these conditioned perceptions of ours to be absolute facts. A few days ago, there was some people came to visit, and we were talking about the different books that had been printed in Malaysia and that had been very kindly, very generously sent over here by the Katanyuta group that had gained tremendous merit, wonderful merit, sending, you know, thousands, 25,000, 30,000 books and CDs and such like over to us here at Amravati, and a quarter of a million altogether all around the world. It's a huge, you know, wonderful, splendid offering. And so amongst the books that they had sent, there was these very fine three-volume collection of Lumpur Cha's teachings, a boxed set of Lumpur Cha's Dhamma talks in English, 53 Dhamma talks. Ajahn Manindo spent many, many months and years putting together and polishing, and finally it all got put into print. And so that we were talking about this as one of the different books that had come in the collection of offerings from the group that the group in Malaysia had printed up. And they were saying how that having this collection of three books, it reminded them of the trilogy of the Lord of the Rings. And so they were sort of chuckling about that it seemed like that it was a bit sort of it was, you know, a wonderful thing to have, but it made them, that's what it brought to mind, it made them think of this sort of, the sort of classic fantasy novel of Tolkien, of the Lord of the Rings. And so we were talking about this, and it was said, oh, I guess that makes you'd have Ajahn Chah cast as Gandalf. And they said, oh, but there wouldn't be any place for Gollum in the Ajahn Chah's Dhamma talks. And I said, oh, no, Gollum's definitely there. You know, Gollum is the embodiment of tanha. That's the embodiment of craving. Because in that, those of you who are familiar with that story, probably most are to some degree. Yeah, you know, that Gollum is in this creature in this constant state of craving. He's besotted with the precious ring that was once his, that is now lost to him, that is it used to be his, and his heart is completely bonded to. But and when he was in possession of the ring, then it gifted him with eternal life, with extraordinary longevity. But also, it was a cause for him being in a state of great say dependency. And so without the ring, then he's in this constant state of longing, craving to be reunited with his precious, my precious. This kind of mind always going towards this precious thing, this wonderful, glorious, my precious, precious. That's he can't get hold of, that's out of his grasp, but is in a state of endless craving, endless hungering for this precious thing. That both is utterly desirable, but yet destroying him at the same time. His body is all wasted away and skinny and scrawny and living in this terrible, sort of desperate, deprived state. So to me, that seemed to be an absolutely perfect depiction of the state of tanha, the mind absorbed in tanha, both compulsively absorbed in that, in a state of endless longing, but yet being destroyed by the very thing that it's addicted to. That it's both can't let go of it, but is being destroyed by it, and is burdened and poisoned by that at the same time. So that's I felt that was a very good image to bring to mind, seeing how that, when the mind is filled with craving, when tanha takes over, then it can be all-consuming. It can seem to be the thing that the mind desires, whether it's a desire for a sense, a pleasurable sense object, something to see or hear or smell or taste or touch, or whether it's the more subtle kinds of craving, the craving to be the aspects of bhava tanha, wanting to be successful, wanting to be concentrated, wanting to be seen as a good person, wanting to be a success, wanting to establish that feeling of I and me and mine in terms of how we are seen by others, or how we preserve our own favored self-image. The different aspects of bhavatanha or vibhavatanha, the desire to get rid of, to not think, to not feel, to switch off, to push away, to negate all feeling, to switch off experience, to not be, to annihilate feeling, to get rid of the chattering mind, to get rid of our unruly emotions, to get rid of difficult situations, to get away from uncomfortable feelings, vibhava tanha. Whatever kind of craving it might be, that if the mind buys into that, then just like poor Gollum, you know, endlessly hungering for this precious thing, but yet knowing that it's in the background, that this is the very thing that's sort of destroying you at the same time. And again, for those of you who are familiar with the story, they also, you'll recollect there's this very, very sort of occasionally arising, rarely arising little voice of wisdom in the back of Gollum's mind that knows that this is a terrible thing that he's caught, he's obsessed with, he's caught up with, and he wants to be free of it, but he can't. So there's the most faint voice of wisdom and nobility that's there in the background. The voice of Hiriyotapa, the voice of wisdom that's functioning there. So when the mind is caught up in tanha of various kinds, that's what obstructs the capacity to really harmonize with each other. When I want you to be different so that I will be happy, then that's tanha. If only you were different, then I would be happy. If only the monastery were not this way, but it was that way. If only, then I would be happy. Just seeing how the way the mind judges the work that we do, the people that we live with, the pattern of the routine, the structure of the teaching, the personalities of the people who are our juniors or our seniors, the way that the mind locks onto to that and says, I want it to be other than the way it is. I want this person to be different. I want to be with this person because they're good and I like them, and I want to be away from that person because they're not good and I don't like them. As soon as the mind locks on to those perceptions and buys into praise and criticism, like and dislike, then we've tied our heart to tanha, where we're kind of chasing our own precious, the precious monastery where everything is perfect. Or I only have to live with people that I like, and I never have to live with people that I dislike, or I never have to be patient with people who are irritating, or never have to be separated from the people that I find inspiring. So in that respect, it's so important for us to be able to see these different aspects of tanha, to see that's what is obstructing the quality of harmony, that's obstructing the quality of samagi. It's not the presence of a particular routine, or the presence of particular people, or the absence of other people. That's not what generates harmony. What generates harmony is that simple and fundamental capacity that we have to recognize craving, to see it arising, to see those judgments that we make about each other, judgments about ourselves, judgments about others, and to see that arising, to know that for what it is, to know that this is just the mind grasping a perception. It's buying into a pattern of craving. It's just feeding that addiction. And that when that's recognized, when that's known, then and is let go of, then we find that samagi is right here, the quality of harmony. It doesn't mean to say that everyone around us is doing things that we like. That doesn't mean to say that the fast ones are slowing down, or the slow ones are speeding up, or that people are always saying things that we approve of are agreeing with us and acting in accordance with our wishes. It doesn't mean that at all. But it means that we are developing a perspective on our wishes, developing a perspective on our judgments. We're not buying into and believing in those patterns of like and dislike, approval and disapproval. We're not taking them as absolute realities. We're rather just seeing, oh, this is the shape of things. This is the particular set of likes and dislikes that arises in this lifetime because of this person's perceptions and conditioning. Yeah, that's the way it's felt and seen and known from this particular corner of the universe. But Why should that be the defining reality? Why should that be the thing to judge every other condition by? So the harmony is established not through straightening out, you know, all the other people around us, but in a way straightening out our own understanding. Again, that the very first rains retreat that Lumpur Sumedho was the abbot at Wat Pananachat way back in the early 70s, mid-70s. And he often would tell the story of how a few weeks into the Vasa, he dragged himself over to Wat Bapong in his miserable state and saying, "Yeah, Lumpur, Lumpur, yeah. It's really difficult. Yeah. All the monks at Wat Pananachat, they won't obey me. Yeah, I'm trying to lead the community in a good way, but yeah, they're just being difficult and obstructive. They won't do what I tell them." And so Lumpur used this example, and I'm sure most of the people here have heard him. Lumpur Sumedho described this. Ajahn Chah said, it's like you get a whole load of people to lie down, all the monks in the monastery to lie down, and you line all their feet up. You draw a line on the ground and you line them all up so that all their feet are together in a very, very neat line. And then you say, okay, everything is nice and true and dead straight. Very, very good. Then you look at the heads, and then the heads are all at odds with each other. They're all they're all out of order. They're all in a kind of wiggly line. So then you realign all the monks so that all their heads are lined up neatly and they're all in a straight line. Okay, now we've finally got them in order. And then you look at their feet. Oh, no, the feet are all out of order now. But no matter how hard you try to line them up, they're always going to be out of true. There's always going to be something that makes a wiggly, wonky line. And so that, Sumedho, you can't get them to... to all be the same. You can't get them to line up. They're not going to be that way. Yeah. Well, so that was obviously a very powerful and useful teaching for Lumpur Sumedho, just recognizing that happiness was not going to come from expecting all of the monks in his monastery to fit a perfect mold, a perfect model, and all be identically obedient and compliant and practice in the way that he would wish and expect, and according to the style, particularly the collection of characters that was gathered together in that the first year at Wat Pananachat. So samagi isn't established. The quality of harmony is not always established around agreeing with each other. And just as I was mentioning this morning at the community meeting that we had, Ajahn Brahma Wangso came to visit a couple of days ago. I had a cup of tea with Ajahn Maninda and myself, a couple of cups of tea, in fact, to be accurate. And as everyone's aware, then there's been a separation here, and part of the discussions that we had was to, in a way, formally decide that yes, he definitely had no interest in being reunited with Wat Bapong, that he was for himself and for his monastic community, for the committee of his monastery, they all were far more inclined towards going their own way, to not try and be reunited with the group of monasteries with Wat Bapong, but to be independent. And so part of the conversation was about that's in a sense choosing to go our separate ways and to establish that as a clear and firm decision. And so it is a divorce, and then the conversation was in a way, obviously with any kind of divorce there's a certain amount of difficulty and discomfort and differences of opinion, different versions of history, as you would expect. But we did our very best not to dwell upon those, but more to just, as with trying to let the divorce be amicable and gracious, to go our separate ways and to spend put our effort into learning, into establishing a quality of, allowing each other to part company and to say live in a respectful and independent fashion, so that the discussion was a lot about the visitation. Like in a divorce, you have like visitation rights for the children. So it's to do with how our different monasteries could and should relate with each other in the future, and establishing those sort of channels of communication and relation. So it was a useful conversation, and in a way, somehow you could say on a level, it was not the result was not samagi in terms of everyone all being sort of fully on the same track. But sometimes concord is not established by everyone in choosing to go down the same track, but the concord is established through recognizing, well, we see things in different ways, and you go your way and I'll go mine. And that's that kind of agreeing to disagree is also its own valid way of finding a place of unity. That you choose to go your way, we'll choose to go our way, and we can allow each other to make those choices with a gracious and respectful attitude. So I think it's good to consider this and to understand that when we are living with each other and establishing concord, we do our best to understand each other. Do we do our best to work with each other? But also, there's times when we realize, well, this particular environment, I've learned a lot from being in this place. I've learned a lot from being with these people, but I feel I flourish a lot better in a smaller place or in a different environment, or I've been in the West long enough, I'd like to go and live in Asia, or I've been in a big community for long enough and I'd like to try and be in a small place for a time. And so that's quite valid in its own way. It's not, as I was saying before, to establish harmony or to establish concord is not just trying to have a kind of monoculture, or having everyone sort of functioning in exactly the same way, but it's also to do with respecting our differences, our limitations, and in this particular instance, where like Ajahn Brahma Wangso choosing to go his own way, well, that's his choice, and there's a lot of history in there, but it's also, you can see that's his prerogative. He's choosing to go his own way. It brings its own results with it, and that we can respect that, and let that go. Just let that be the particular the results of a particular set of choices and actions, and we can leave it alone. Just as we someone that we live with, we can say we're quite happy in this place, and someone says, well, I've been at Amaravati for quite a while and I'd like to go off to be in a smaller place. We don't have to criticize them or blame them and say, well, if you were really knew how to practice properly, you just stay here at Amaravati, and you wouldn't need to go to a small place. But instead, we can recognize, well, why should that not be the case? That why shouldn't they choose to go and be in a different environment, and maybe that can indeed be something very beneficial and helpful and a blessing to them. We don't just judge others according to our own particular pattern, but also we make space for others to go their own way. So we're not looking at samagi just as a everyone doing the same thing, or as a establishing a monoculture, or in everyone being just sort of wishy-washy and trying to find the lowest common denominator, and being a kind of passive over pliable, but to in a sense find that place of respectfulness, that place of of understanding within us that can say, yes, well, this is what I like to do and I feel comfortable doing this and this is where I feel at home, but why should everybody else feel the same way? You know, why shouldn't, I don't need to be intimidated by others wishing to do different things or go to different places or find benefit in different circumstances. So the place of concord is in our attitude of, say, of understanding that the place of recognizing that there are many colors in the universe, that there are the different situations suit different people at different times, and that when we are, say, confident in our own understanding, we can look at our own life, we see what benefits us and what helps us to flourish, and we don't feel that we have to judge everybody else according to that same pattern, then we find that we're able to be in accord with all sorts of different circumstances. We find a true capacity in our own heart to accommodate all those different colors, to be able to appreciate the qualities of all those different colors of the universe, that we recognize our own disposition, our own patterning, our own conditioning, but that doesn't dominate the whole field. And so there's a tremendous freedom, a tremendous peacefulness that comes with that. Maybe the last thing to reflect on in this, it's mysterious how it does work, that when we develop the practice of communality, learning to live with each other, learning to use the frictions of being with each other to wake up, to sharpen our wisdom faculty, that's a lot to do with committing. If we are here and we've all been together for the 3 months of the Vasa and been living in each other's company for this time, and learning to deal and hopefully develop wisdom from the different kinds of friction that we've been experiencing here and there. So we do the best to learn from that. So there's a quality of commitment. We avow to be in the same place together for the rains. We avow to live harmoniously together. So there's a commitment. There's a quality of belonging and a uniformity, following the same structures, the same routines, the same disciplines, so that there is a limitation that's there. And Sangha life, and particularly living in community and living as closely in community as we do, there's a definite limitation. There's a lot of giving up, you know, giving up what we want to do in order to fit in with what the group is doing. Letting go and surrendering to the form, these kind of phrases that get used a tremendous amount. Surrendering to the routine, to the form, giving up what we wish to do in order to fit in with the others and the communal pattern of things. And often that's the very point of friction, is that, well, I don't want to do that. I don't want to do that kind of a work. I don't want to be, I want to do something else today. I want to do something different. And that then that point of friction is where we recognize that, we see that, we feel that, and then let go. So that there's a very strong ethic of conformity, and in that communality of joining together with others and being part of a group, there is a confinement, there's a commitment to a form. And so that can be seen as a great limitation, something that is closing us in. And if we don't handle the training skillfully, then it can become a real prison or really suffocating, a real sort of a straitjacket that we find ourselves in. But the Buddha said a number of times that just as all the oceans of the world, if you any of the seven oceans of the world, if you dip your finger in and you taste it, they all have one taste, the taste of salt. So too, wherever you dip your finger into the teachings have one taste, and that's the taste of liberation, the taste of freedom. So that it's important to consider when we are looking at community life and considering that those qualities of conformity, of joining in with the routine, of surrendering to the form, and letting go of personal preference and personal impulses, that that is, those are structures that are established by the Buddha, by our teachers, by Lumpo Cha, Lumpo Sumedho, as conducive to freedom. So this is an important thing to consider, how it is that when we are training, we're in a way meeting those qualities of limitation, of conformity, of commitment, when they are met with wisdom, with an attitude of mindfulness and clear comprehension, when we use that meeting with limitation as a cause to wake up, to see our own biases, our own habits of bhavatanna, vipavatanna, desire to become, desire to get rid of, sense desire and so on, then it's through seeing those habits of craving, those biases, the latent tendencies, the anusaya, these are through being seen, that's how we free the heart from them, so that there's this mysterious way that through the skillful use of containment, through the skillful use of meeting with that kind of friction, through that commitment, then what results is freedom. It is definitely an explicit and deliberate containment, like taking the eight precepts or taking the monastic precepts that we live by. It's a deliberate containment, but it's a confinement, a containment, a commitment that leads to freedom. Just as getting in, like the example I like to use most often is getting into a car. You know, we don't mind getting into a little box or into a bus and being confined to a particular seat, strapped in with our seat belt, because if we get into that seat and get strapped in and sit there, then given a good driver and a skillful time on the road, then we'll get all the way to Chithurst or to Harnham or to London or wherever it is that we're going to get to. So that confinement, that containment, allows a greater freedom through that confinement, through that commitment to see the causes of dukkha, to see those forms of tanha, to see what that is and how that works, then the heart can be freed from it, so that then in this mysterious way it's through using sangha life, the sangha refuge as a form of training, the community life as a form of training, then we find an extraordinarily profound quality of independence. And this is one of the ways the Buddha characterized the fruition of the practice, is that stream entry is often described as being independent of others in the teacher's dispensation. So that it's through this methodology of sangha life, of using a commitment to the form of monastic life, commitment to living in community, and the mechanics, the nature of community life, this helps us to develop an independence. It's mysterious how this works, that through the living in community and the support of the community and the encouragement and inspiration and all the lessons that come from living in community, then it's an independence is what arises from that. That there's a sense of a freedom, of reliance, that we're not, even though it's through the means of being with others that we've learned these lessons, then those very lessons help us to not need others. They help them to not be dependent on others, and not to be dependent on circumstance, not to be dependent on the external situation. So I offer these thoughts for consideration this evening, and whatever is useful, please take it and keep it, and whatever is not useful, then please leave it aside.
Andamayam dhamma uvarigata sadhukaram dhamase
sadhu 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 anumodhanami.
Well, tonight being the observance day, as everybody is aware, then people are heartily welcomed, invited to carry on the vigil through till midnight. Those of you who need to return to your homes or carry on with other activities, other duties elsewhere, please take care of those. And those of you who are part of the resident community and able to stay up, and then please join in with the rest of the vigil, and we'll close with a short chant of some kind at midnight.